Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is episode 201. And we were talking about a whole range of different things. I was joined this week by Joe Kirk and Katarina Santos. How do you think it went, guys?
Hello.
Yeah,
I think it went pretty good. A lot of chat from the chat.
Chat from the chat.
And a couple of people dived in multiple times, actually, with some really interesting and thought-provoking things. So, yeah, I think the session went pretty good.
It's always good when they participate, don't they?
Yeah, what was your highlight then? What was the best part of the discussion, do you think?
Well, I quite enjoyed the conflict of interest when I threw a spanner in the works and just flipped the podcast on its head. We had a conversation around kind of, Kane had a query come in the support desk around what do you do when you've got somebody who is an employee for your organization, but he's also a tenant at the same time? How do you combat kind of privacy around kind of, you know, ensuring that the individual is able to fulfill their role as an employee, but making sure that they don't use personal data that they may access, you know, against data subjects, neighbors, for example, that they otherwise wouldn't have the information if they weren't an employee. So I think that was quite a good conversation and probably my highlight of the session.
Okay, what was your
point? Yeah, that was a really, really good point. But I think my favorite point was the fact that the UK government has amended the data use and SaaS bill that allowing it now to benefit from the soft opt-in exemptions for email and text marketing that
charities.
was previously charities. It was just reserved for commercial businesses. So we dive into what is a soft opt-in and what can it be expected the charities, if it can approve, what can charities can expect from it. And was a really good one. Dive into the definition on what it can be a similar product or service. We had some engagement of the audience as well. So I think this was my highlight of the day.
All right, very good. Well, I think I really enjoyed both of those things and the other things we talked about as well. But I think I quite liked the discussion about the increase or proposed increase in the data controller fees. And I think that there's quite interesting comments from the participants, you know, the live listeners about, you know, the impacts of those fees on different types of organizations. And I think that was a good discussion. One of the things I meant to mention, I've written on my notes and I forgot, is International Data Protection Day. We need to keep ramming home the point, International Data Protection Day on the 28th of January. So we need people to remind people about that. And then the other thing we talked about was the ICO's consultation on its approach to the public sector. We're encouraging people, you know, if you've got a view, you know, get on the survey and make your points, really. So anyway, that was the session. It was a good session, quite well attended, and we hope you enjoy it.
GDPR radio.
I feel like I've been away for a fortnight. I've only actually had 4 days off. 4 days off, but there you go. So a GDPR radio, so that's news and views and chat and banter.
Banter, yeah, very much so. And any bodily noises that come our way.
Yes, indeed, yes. So you've both had a busy week. What have you had a chance to have a quick look at the news to see what's been going on in the world of data protection?
I have, actually, and I wanted to start, actually, by two things. One, reminding people that the ICO, you can submit your opinion on its public sector approach. I think that ends, might be next week or the week after. 31st of January is when it closes soon. So I just want to remind anyone, if they want to fill in the survey and provide feedback that they're looking for, I think they're seeking input on who will be included in the approach and the circumstances that will lead to a fine. And apparently the consultation can be responded to through a survey. So I'll put a link up to that in the chat for anybody.
Have you done it, Joe? Have you done it?
No, and I probably should, shouldn't I? Because
I'm just interested what they're aiming to accomplish by this, or what they're expecting. You know, and how would you complete it? Would you be completing it then? No, we think that they should be treated the same as any other organisation and fined accordingly, or would you be saying it's a recycling of taxpayers' cash?
I've had quite a strong opinion, haven't I, on here over the past kind of 18 months or so about their approach, saying that, yes, it's fair enough saying that you're not going to find them, you're just going to offer reprimands, but you've got to do a little bit more than that, I think. with these organisations, especially, you know, like the police service. Northern Ireland was a massive breach, wasn't it, back in 2023, and had some real implications on the data subjects, and it almost felt like it got brushed under the carpet a little bit. The NHS has found themselves in, you know, similar circumstances, I guess, with breaches. And I think when it's such sensitive information, as has happened in there, I think a reprimand is not quite enough. So I probably should fill it out and offer my thoughts, yes, but I haven't so far.
Yeah,
I put the survey in the wrong chat.
I was going to say, I thought you'd put it in the chat, but I can't see it. It's a chat.
I've put it in our kit chat. I've put it in the wrong thing. It should be in there now for everybody if they want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, Amy's got a good point. You know, if they can't really win, can they? If they find them, it's taking money out of already tight, you know, public services. If you know, people then moan about it to two-tier system, and if you do find them, you know, it takes money out of circulation. If you don't find them, everyone says, well, it's not fair. I mean, Gateshead Council had a breach this week, I saw, and, you know, public authority, you know, lots of sensitive data, you know, I don't know, but I'll have a look at the survey and I'll see, you know, I'll probably make some snap decisions about how I think it should work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think that fines are the right way to go down, because I do agree that it is a waste of taxpayers' money. But, you know, can they not send people in and assist, do training, any sort of workshops? You know, I know, I guess then it comes out of the resources of the ICO, but, you know, that's what they're there for, isn't it?
Yeah, they should be monitored. Yeah, I agree.
Maybe there should be a system, like, you know, if you put a business into administration, the administrators move in and start influencing how it's run. Maybe there should be a system like that. Maybe they should be getting consultancy firms to do that kind of administrative work. That'd be it's fantastic, wouldn't it? I might suggest that, actually.
That's a good idea to include in the survey.
Yeah.
And also, while we're on the topic of the ICO, did you see that the government are set to increase the fee that's payable by data controllers to the ICO? And it's the first increase since 2018, I believe, going up 37.2% to take account of inflationary increases, and in order to provide the ICO with necessary funding to discharge their legal responsibilities. So I think tier one, which is currently £40, will raise to £52. Tier two is £60, will raise to £78, and tier three will go from £2,900 to £3,763. I'm not sure when that will come into force.
But what do you think about that? I mean, are the fees reasonably low anyway? You know, is there room for improvement? I mean, everything's going up, isn't it? There's just a general increase all the time on everything, taxes, and, you know, this is going up as well. But £52, you know, that's not a massive amount, is it?
Not really. So. Are we tier one, are we, Phil? So would that just be a £12 increase for us?
I honestly can't remember. We might have gone over into tier two on the number of based on number of employees. I can't remember.
But it's,
I think,
not
we
a
have
great
actually,
deal, that, is
when
it?
We did an internal audit, we highlighted that we were in the wrong tier. So I think we are registered in tier two now. But it's not a huge amount of money for many organisations. I don't know how many are registered. Last time I checked, the register was over a million, but not that many more than a million. So I don't know whether the issue is that you know, the fees are too low, or they're just not very good at raking the fees in.
Yeah, sorry, there's a few things in the chat. Shane said there'll still be a £5 discount for paying by direct debit. So if you want to save some, if you want some change, then direct debit's the way to go.
Yeah, which is just, you know, 10% of the tier one and a fraction of a percent of tier three. Hybrid. I don't know how our hybrid organisations would get treated. Be interesting to see what their approach would be. But again, if we've got views on this, then we ought to get onto the survey and kind of voice our opinions. I'm not sure whether we'll be listened to, but there you go. Are you reading the chat, you two? You seem both
excited.
I am,
yeah. Sorry.
Are you ogling the coffee machine, Kate?
No, I'm just reading the chat saying we are a public authority, so it will be an 800% increase. Not great with the budget pressures. Yeah. I'm just thinking about the small organizations and actually the public authorities and local authorities, because we're talking about almost, in this case, like almost 1,000 quid on he increase, but well.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a school's normally tier three then, because that would probably where it will pinch the most.
Yeah.
If that is the case. Although, do you know, I saw something on LinkedIn the other day about, you know, the Federation of Small Businesses, they wrote to the ICO complaining about, I think, the fee that they have to pay. Because it's, I think it's like £50, I think, the core buy. They got quite a lot of backlash on there because they were saying that the ICO doesn't really put too much out for SMEs. But I actually saw quite a lot of defence for the ICO, and I think that's the first time in a long time that I've seen people defend them. So it was something to keep an eye on for sure. But what about you, Phil? Did you manage to find any news pieces while you were flying down the slopes in Switzerland?
I saw a couple of things actually, yeah, which I want to talk about. But on this fees thing, you know, the comments in the chat are, you know, it's £800, and you mentioned about schools. You know, I know that schools have got tight budgets. I mean, my wife's an auditor for or a bursar for a number of small rural primary schools in North Yorkshire, and some of them have got like 12 children. You know, they've got mega tight budgets, really, really tight. You know, you're taking money out of those budgets to go into the ICO. You know, should it be just funded from central government rather than from the fee payers? You know, I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, I hear what people are saying. I think it's, you know, for a business like us, you know, a £18 increase is nothing, is it? Really, when you look at it, you know, we'll spend that on a round of coffees, won't we? Which is, but, yeah, you've got a organisation that gets into tier two on the basis of number of employees or you know, if they're public sector, and you know, it's 1,000 was, as you quite rightly say, nearly, and that's a, you know, potentially a lot of money, much more of an impact on some organizations than others. But how do you fairly do it? How do you do it? Should you have two tiers, like commercial fees and private sector fees and charity fees? You're just overly complicating it then. I don't know why it just doesn't go back to you know, funded from central government. But
Is that what it used to be then?
Well, I'm pretty sure, yeah. In the back in the early days, I'm pretty
sure.
For
everybody,
sure it
is it, sorry, or just public sector?
No, for everybody. I don't remember there being a fee when the first ICO was first set up. I don't remember it. I mean, I might be wrong, but
I can't wrap my head around why. Do you know when the ICO issues fines and stuff, why do they not get a chunk of a fine that they've gone and, if they've gone and, you know, taken somebody to court for $6 million, for example, say Clearview AI, they got fined $6 million, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think it was Clearview AI. You know, why do they not get a chunk of that to help them with the resources, as opposed to data controllers having to pay a fee?
Don't know.
But surely that would then increase the appetite of, or maybe the bite that the ICO lacks at the moment, to go out and actually, you know, press charges, but, you know, issue fines against people who are not compliant, because it just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think we should fill in the survey and voice our opinions and maybe come up with some suggestions. Maybe. Now, I saw that the ICO had put out some interesting stuff about people who were thinking about starting a business in the new tax year, they said, then make sure that you think about data protection from the outset. So I had a look at that. And they're saying, you know, the things that the ICO can do for you as a entrepreneur or small business is they have the e-learning site specifically for small businesses, which I have had a look at before. And some of it is actually pretty good. They've got a privacy notice generator that they're suggesting use that to generate your privacy information, which I have to say I haven't used. But I did have a look at their direct marketing advice generator. I thought, oh, I've not seen this before. So I had a quick click on that to see how it worked. And I'm not convinced about it. I'll have to find a link to it. So it started off asking me about, are you going to do some direct marketing? Yeah. You know, are you going to do a service message? I said, yeah. And then it finished. I downloaded the advice and thought, right, okay, well, I'll just bolt a bit of direct marketing on the back of that. So it didn't quite go where I expected it to go. I expected it to then ask me more questions about, more advice about, make sure you make, don't put
anything. What was the advice that was provided? What was the advice that you received?
I'd have to download it again. I can't, hang on. I'll do it again. It takes a few minutes.
The literally.
First question, advice generator. In fact,
that does set a dangerous precedent, doesn't it? Because some organizations we know that we've dealt with some customers that they want to send service messages and they do something that's known as sugging. I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but it's kind of where you phrase it as a service message, but the real intention behind it is actually direct marketing. And when you do that, it is considered to be direct marketing. So I think people will probably do that and go, well, look, ITO, I went on your generator and I said I'm intending to do service messaging and you've told me that's fine.
Yeah. So this is the generator. I don't know if you can see my screen. This is the generator.
Yeah, I can
so
see
I,
it,
I expected this to go a step further, you know, and start warning me about making sure I wasn't sugging anything. But I'm not sure. It says here you must make sure they don't include any promotional content. But I would have thought there'd be maybe a couple of extra steps in this, you know, direct marketing advice generated tool. But anyway, that again, I haven't seen this before. So I want to give it a bit of a thorough test. It says it can take up to 15 minutes or less than 15 minutes to complete. But, you know, it's either, you know, going to be really helpful.
Yes or no. Mm-hmm.
You know, or it's not, you know.
So I did have a look at the privacy policy generator and that was rubbish.
Right. Okay.
Mm.
I'm certainly
not provided any advice on that. No details, just asking questions and asking what you want.
I can't remember, but it was just the information. I don't think it asked for explicit legitimate interests. I think that was one of the standout. But I'm certain we spoke about it last year on here and said it's not very good at all. So it's quite. Mm. Quite concerning, isn't it?
I think probably they are just strict to the law, and I think we already spoke about it, and we consider that they are just strict to the law and the requirements and the UK GDPR, and come to the conclusion that the privacy notice needs obviously more detail and more granular in order to be transferred to the individuals. I don't know. And the same thing with the direct marketing advice generator. I was expecting more questions probably because I did it as well. And something like I wanted to send like a service message to like B2B, B2C and like differences between all of them. But no. Oh, well. Is it useful?
I thought it was useful, but I thought that you could end up doing the wrong thing. Having used the advice generator, which, you know, potentially, you know, could be quite worrying.
I mean, I can see that they send a few guidance, such as what is a service message, yes or no example. So, but well, this can lead to completely wrong advice, and people will, as you were saying, Joe, I think people. We'll just rely. Oh, but you said this. You said it was all right. What about that? What do I do now? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was quite interesting. I saw also this week, again, I was surprised I saw this because this happened several years ago. But apparently French submarine crews have been using Strava, and that you can, you know, their whereabouts, their shift patterns, you know, everything like that has been tracked or trackable on Strava. And then this story I read also, which is on Euronews, was also saying that you could track the whereabouts of President Biden and President Macron through finding their security services close protection teams on Strava, and then find out where they were moving around. But this happened in Afghanistan, didn't it? So it must have been 2018, 19, maybe.
I'm not sure. No.
Where US personnel, you could find, you know, the military bases in Afghanistan on the basis of the Strava data.
Oh, I do remember that, actually. Yeah, because there just be a loop of people running around the thing. But, you know, this just comes down to internal policy, doesn't it? You know, if you're a security of a president in America, you know, do you have to use Strava? I mean, I guess maybe the point is that they didn't know that it was being shared, I guess. But
no, the problem was that they hadn't accommodated smart. They hadn't thought about smartwatches. So that you know, you got to hand your phones in, hand you this, the next thing in. But they seem to have not thought about smartwatches.
Yeah, because the use of smartwatches, it will monitor the use of the like heart rates and movements and location and anything you do. Yeah, the fact that they didn't thought about it. Wow.
I just wondered what else we might have about our persons that give your location away. Do those air tags, do they give location, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's probably lots of different things. I think Lawrence is saying the same kind of thing. There's possibly, you know, other devices that we're, you know, we've got, and that you know, also give our location away.
Yeah, I kind of want to flip the podcast on its head a little bit and take it in a different direction, if that's okay. Because we speak a little bit about news, but we had an interest. Well, Kane had an interesting case come his way in support. And I think it's something that a lot of our listeners, since we work quite heavily in social housing, it's something that people are probably going to come across quite a bit. And it's around when an individual is both an employee and a tenant, and kind of the conflict of interest that kind of comes with that. So this came from one of our customers. There was a discussion between colleague and resident panel regarding an issue in regards to how, let's call them, Organization X balances colleagues and residents' roles in terms of privacy and data protection. Specifically, the panel raised concerns relating to colleagues who are residents of Organization X and how other colleagues can access their personal information, such as rent accounts and personal documents held within our systems. The two key points from included that, you know, reviewing practices to ensure access to personal information is appropriate and necessary, and ensuring all practices are fully compliant with the GDPR and privacy standards. However, in terms of privacy and GDPR, they wanted some advice as to, you know, what can be done in relation to an individual who is both a tenant and an employee, and kind of how do you kind of mitigate any sort of risk, I guess, of... Do you kind of understand what I'm posing?
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's been an issue ever since we formed Age Protection People. It was one of the first questions. Oh, Lawrence got his hand up, so should we take, and David has as well. In fact, should we pause that and take the
yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say on that is a lot of times when you have that, you have to declare an interest so somebody else looks up your account checks in for you, so that if you're both a member and a client of something, you have to work something out so that you don't end up looking at your own stuff, because that'd be illegal. You know, that would be a breach of the GDPR if you looked up your own data in your own system, because you're not authorized to access your own account. You know, if you're a bank employee, for example, you would not be authorized to access and assess your own bank account on the internal machines. You have to become the customer at that point and then have somebody externally do it for you. So you'd have to have that set up. Otherwise, the organization would have a breach of the GDPR, and the individual doing it would be breaching the GDPR as well.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, I think. You know, it does make sense. David, do you want to come in?
Yeah, I think there'd be circumstances in banking, as Lauren says. I'm not sure it's a breach of the GDPR, looking at your own data, unless you're explicitly advised not to. We have for me, I was smiling because it's no different than exactly the same situation in every HR department, because somebody's HR for HR, and it's always somebody within the country, within the function, who can see everybody else's data. And as long as you've got the correct controls and the correct guidance in place, that's how we operate. I think what Lawrence is talking about slightly different. Clearly, people cannot transact on themselves because, well, one, systems won't allow it, but two, it's a breach of, breach of ethics. Our controls and our ethics. However, I don't see it as a GDPR breach. They're able to see the personal data of everybody in the UK because that is the team that they support. If they ran a report of everybody in the UK, because that's what they're supporting, I'd expect it to show themselves because they're part of the UK. Otherwise, their headcount would be one down. So I think it's no different. I think, interestingly, Joe, there's some other things that I'd be thinking of is more from another area I worked, which is I came through for a small point, physical, global security, and it'd be more protection of people and things like that. So who is getting access to that personal information, and do we have the same sort of trust you would if it was a people department? And, you know, are you giving access to maybe a line manager just because they're a tenant who, you know, is that correct? So maybe some safeguarding had come into it, but I'm not sure there's a privacy issue. But
if you're passing somewhere, Mark, bring me a snack.
Oh, somebody's not on mute, but I'll have a snack. I'm sure everybody can have their own opinion, but that's how I'd see it anyway. But I explicitly don't see it any different to every HR department, and therefore the same considerations that come across.
I guess where it could become an issue is if I was working in finance, for example, for a housing association, and I see that my neighbour's in rent arrears, and then I'm able to use that against that person, I think that's where it may become a slight issue. And I think that's kind of maybe where the premise of the question kind of comes from, in terms of how do you mitigate that? I think it'll come down to internal policy, won't it? And when you're acting in your capacity as a finance manager, for example, that is what you are. And it's kind of, does it come down to training and reminding your staff that, look, you're going to see this information, but you need to make sure that you're looking at it as a employee and not as a tenant?
I think
is that enough? Or?
Well, I think what Lawrence and Dara said is exactly right. That, you know, this occurs as soon as you have a customer that's also an employee or a colleague, whatever, you're going to end up with the same scenario. So tenant is no different. However, you know, the type of information that might be collected about tenants might go further than some other commercial relationships, maybe not as far, you know, HR possibly goes as far, if not further, you know, mm-hmm. medical information. But if you've got, you know, I remember looking at this years ago, right, and, you know, people are saying, well, if somebody's complained about, you know, this individual as a tenant, as a neighbour, and then is it right that the rest of the workforce can see that? You know, if they've got family issues, you know, and mental health issues, or, you know, things that they don't really want publicising throughout the workforce, you know, that those records are on the systems. And, you know, it's right that people don't have unfettered access to them. But that's down, I think, as what people are saying. So, controls, you know, if you can't get technical control in there, which you could, you know, if you've got decent systems. Part of the problem is that when I haven't looked at housing management systems in detail for a number of years, but when I did look at them, they were woeful in terms of the way they allowed management and segregated management and access to data. Absolutely woeful. So we're a big Salesforce user. So you've got, you know, field level control, record level control, object level control. So you could ring fence it and write some rules and say, these people can't see these fields on these types of individuals, you know, and you've got unlimited ways of segmenting the data. But when I looked at 4 or 5, because we did studies of them, they asked us to go in and advise them about how they can make their systems more friendly towards GDPR. They were horrendous. Like, there's no role-based access control whatsoever on 2 of the systems I looked at. So that was a problem. You know, but if you could put technical controls in, fine. You then got to put policy in. Now, I noticed this week in the news also that 2 police forces chief constables have been suspended pending investigations for, you know, exactly this. One was like accessing data unauthorized access of data, and the other chief constable got suspended for not investigating a colleague who seemed to retire with a load of sensitive data. So. And I know they're not regulated by the GDPR, it's Data Protection Act stuff, but it's all very, very similar in this respect. But I think, I'm surprised, actually, if I'm being honest, Joe, that this has cropped up again, because I thought we'd kind of managed to put this kind of to bed. You know, it is important that all customers, tenants, whatever, feel that there is adequate control over the access to their data. Mm-hmm. And to think that's not in place now, 6 years after GDPR came into effect, is surprising, if I'm being honest.
I think in here is all about the security controls that are actually implemented. And I feel like, for example, in this specific case, I think probably like a segregation of duties where like employees cannot measure their own tenancy or any other accounts, or require like a second person to approve any access to any type of information. But I feel like the experience that I have is in reviewing, for example, policies and governance, information governance documentation, etc. I always feel that in theory, the organizations actually list all the security controls and measures they actually are supposed to have in place. But in practice, they don't do. I count like 2 or 3 that they actually don't have anything implemented. Obviously, in the policy they have, but actually in practice they don't have. And again, I'm not sure in years, because DEFO is a conflict of interest. But in the end of the day, it's always based on the set controls. But again, will depend on probably the resources that each organization might have, and even the training that the people have in this regard.
Yeah. I mean, how are you tracking access as well? So there was another, I'll just come to you in a second, there was another police thing where a call handler has been imprisoned actually for 6 months because he received a call from a member of the public on 999, and it was about one of his friends. It was, this person was accusing of dealing drugs. He texted his friend to say, you know, get yourself out of this place because there's a complaint. His friend went round and confronted the person who'd put the 999 call in, which is how they found out. And he's been in prison for 6 months. And, you know, so how are you finding out that people are accessing records?
Mm.
Lawrence, over to you.
Yeah, thanks. I was just wondering if an organization is stuck and they don't have adequate technological controls, would it be enough of a defense to have, let's say, a policy or procedure and training to say you don't access your accounts or don't do X, even though they don't have the technological role controls? Would that be sufficient?
Yeah, I would say yes, because the GDPR makes allowance for the state of the art and for the cost of implementing technological controls. Now, if you could say, you know, in the context of this organization, it's going to cost, and you know, I think it depends on the case by case basis, it's going to cost X to put in place technological controls, therefore we put in, you know, soft controls. That GDPR permits that, allows that, doesn't it? I would have said. But I think you have to look at it. We'd have to look at it on a case by case basis. You know, maybe a huge multinational corporation with millions of in profits or billions in profits wouldn't necessarily be able to use that kind of defence, but maybe other organisations would.
Yeah, it's appropriate measures, isn't it? So it depend on the data that's being processed as well.
Yeah, but I think Lawrence makes a great point about, you know, a lot of systems are built for access for all on a collaborative basis, on a kind of a US privacy model, let's call it, you know, and I think that's probably a good point. But all the housing management systems that we looked at back in 2017-16 were all UK companies, and they were all not very good, if I'm being honest. But the other thing that I know I thought about this police call handler is, you know, this individual has been imprisoned for the an offence under the public office misuse. It's a public office offence. Let me just check my notes. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. If data protection and privacy is such an important thing, and you're imprisoning people for, you know, the misuse of data, and you're suspending police chief constables for misuse of private of data, then why aren't the custodial sentences built into the GDPR and the Data Protection Act? I mean, I just don't understand why there aren't. Every time the ICA wants to imprison somebody, they have to use the Computer Misuse Act or some other form of legislation. If it's so important, so serious, and such a big issue, why is it not a provision, you know, and something that's built into the actual, you know, data protection legislation?
That's a good question. I think. It's a good question. I think probably because we required any proof of intentional misconduct and or like severe harm or severe negligence, because normally the misuse of information is more, well, can be harmful, but there is no intention behind it, isn't it? So I'm not sure if we'll be surrounded it. I'm not sure.
Well, you'd only expect to use those provisions where there was obvious intent, you know, to commit that kind of offense. Lawrence is coming in again. Lawrence,
I was just going to say, sometimes with custodial sentences, though, you have a whole different charging regime. So it's sort of like putting it into a fast track where it's almost like a misdemeanor. So while data things can have larger upsides, but that's very rare, the regular occurrence is probably more your office making a mistake rather than intentional, and then a consequence of harm to someone in a manifest way, such as harm to property or person, like somebody gets killed, for example, most extreme example. So I think if they had a custodial sidetrack, I think they had a discussion about custodial at the time, because some of this was after the News of the World and the phone hacking. There was a discussion of whether this should be custodial, but that the consequence of trying to get someone charged, I think this is really, I'm stretching my memory here and my understanding of it, is that there was something about the fact that the custodial process puts you into a different legal framework for the CPS to charge, and then what the requirement of proof is as well to get somebody put away, so to speak, versus what you have for these type of crimes, where it gets a bit messy, like, you know, were you authorized, was it, wasn't, who gave it to you, why, what was your public interest? And I think that's lower level or lower temperature, so to speak. And that was a differential. But there would be some debate in Parliament or around that time that covered that off.
Yeah. All good points. If it was there, you don't have to necessarily use it, but it then becomes a bit of a deterrent. You know, I suppose that the people will be weighing up if they even knew about it. You know, well, you know, what's the chances of the, you know, kind of criminal courts and the CPS getting engaged? But in really serious cases, you know, the ones that spring to mind are the Nationwide employees. You know, the people that were stealing the accident data and selling it on. One guy got. Again, he got 6 months for that, but that was under the Computer Misuse Act. So there's just, the question was why, what, you know, should there be a provision in data protection law as opposed to other laws, you know, as well as maybe, don't know, but good points.
Is it in any privacy laws around the world? Is there any sort of?
Yeah, in Jamaica. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, even work in Jamaica, in Jamaican law, there's 10 years is the maximum.
Right. 10 years.
Yeah.
There is any criteria for that, or will be depending on the crime?
Well, it depends. There's two court systems, and there are fines and custodial sentences actually outlined, though, in the Jamaican Data Protection Act.
Okay.
It's only recently, you know, like a year ago, started to get.
Okay.
It came into effect in 2020, but it's only last year actually, and they've actually started to get things moving on it. But there's been no cases yet, you know, but it's in there. It's written in there into the law. That's now, when we're doing training, you know, we're saying, you know, this is ultimately something that might arise.
come across, please be aware. People are sitting up. that actually happens in China as well, apparently.
Yeah. And there's other, you know, there's other thing. I mean, other things in other laws that you know, in the Jamaican law that I really like. Like there's an annual, they call the date DPIA, and it's an annual return you've got to fill in. So you've got to have a registration and you've got to do an annual return by the end of March every year, which sounds like it's kind of like summarizing what you've been doing. It's not been defined yet what that is. And a data protection officer has to report contraventions of the law as well as data breaches. Now, you know, there's a process there. So if you have a contravention, then you have to give the data controller sufficient time and pointers to fix that contravention, but ultimately the DPO is legally obliged to report a contravention. That puts a huge amount of conflict inside an organization, potential
That's
conflict.
That's really interesting. I know that you have been working in Jamaican data protection law for quite long now. Is there anything that you actually would recommend for the legislator to include in our UK?
Yeah, those three things. Those three things.
Aside from this.
I think the registration, again, the ROPAs are all well and good, but why is it not a public-facing document? You know, I don't know. The registration document used to be. Registration, particularly in Jamaica, are public-facing. I think the annual return kind of thing or an annual audit would be a good thing, and there might
That's
be some cut-offs, like,
a good,
you know,
idea.
For a certain size or a certain complexity or a certain type of data being processed. You know, I think it makes sense to have an audit regime enforced, you know, even if it's every 3 years, but there's just nothing, is there?
Yeah. It's actually monitoring.
But I mean, the key thing will be to see how the Office of the Inferior Commission in Jamaica enforces the law. You know, we don't know yet.
Yeah, quite curious to see that.
Yeah. Anyway. Where were we? I can't remember what we're talking about. We're talking about conflict.
Conflict, yeah.
Oh, the conflict, yeah. So what was your general thoughts then on that then, Joe? You know, you obviously talked to Kane about it, yeah.
Yeah, I think just pretty much what we've discussed, kind of just that you need to make sure that you put appropriate measures in place, and whether that's technical or operational, and just make sure that staff are trained adequately and, you know, a reminder of the responsibilities when handling information. Was pretty much the summary of it, I think.
Right. Now, what else
I think
have you...
It's important, sorry, just to finish, I think it's important also to making sure that if anything is implemented in terms of policies and precision, and we came to the conclusion that might have like a conflict of interest in here, we need to make sure that there are actually some definition and enforcement of any penalties that if there are any restriction, if the tenants slash employees who try to bypass these restrictions, for example, to assess their tenant data or anything, they actually have some penalties implemented. Because something that I normally come across in review of policies is always missing a little bit of the penalties or disciplinary kind of section, and I well, it's something that I always include in there because it's actually the consequence of the infringement of this policy, isn't it? So I think it's important to actually define them.
I think you're spot on. I think you're spot on there. Now, didn't you want to talk about a couple of things? One is the change in the soft opt-in for charities. I've noticed that you potentially want to chat through that. And also the ruling that the European Court of Justice about the GDPR complaints can't be rejected on the basis of frequency. So I don't know if these are two things you want to cover off.
Yeah, Kate, do you want to take the lead on the soft opt-in?
Yes, of course. So let me just... So in terms of the DUA bill, the government has adopted an amendment to the DUA bill, which the charities will, with the soft opt-in mechanism, will be extended to the charities. Well, just a quick summary. So in terms of the soft opt-in, when what it is and when can be relied on, can be relied when all the conditions are met in terms of the packer. When, for example, a person's contact details are collected during the course of a sale, negotiations for a sale or a product or service, an opportunity to refuse or opt out the marketing is given to the point of collection, and in every subsequent communication, the marketing can be sent only about the similar products and services, and there is always provide the ability for individuals to opt out in every communication. And until now, the charities would not be caught in the ear because of the commercial part of the soft-in requirements. But now, with these amendments, was included the fact that the direct marketing will be caught the charities. And I think this is quite interesting because it will change a little bit of how we apply out the law and our advice. And things, the DUA bill now states that a charity may send or instigate the sending of electronic mail for the purpose of direct marketing, where the sole purpose of the direct marketing is to further one or more of the charity's charitable purpose, and the charity obtained the contact details of the recipient of the electronic mail in the course of the recipient expressing an interest in one or more of the purpose that were the charity's charitable purpose at the time, or offering or providing support to further one or more of those purpose. And finally, the recipient has been given a simple means of refusing, free of charge, except for the costs of the transmission of the refusal, the use of their contact details for the purpose of direct marketing by the charity at the time that the details were initially collected, and where the recipient did not initially refuse to the use of the details at the time of each subsequent communications. And I feel that the fact that the charity is being considered here is a huge, huge, huge step. Obviously, the DUA bill is not being, we are still waiting for it, but if it's approved and if it be used for the future, I think there are a few steps that the charities need to be aware. For example, in terms of, will be like a CRM system be able to store multiple permissions? If happens, will the supporters find it confusing if suddenly switch one or the other? There are a few things that we should consider it for the charities. Not so about your thoughts on this.
I thought it was always wrong. I thought the ICA was always interpreting the law incorrectly, and you know, it was grossly unfair that, you know, they were interpreting that kind of commercial piece as well. That's obviously for profit, and a not for profit can't be for profit. Therefore, but it was just ridiculous. I thought, you know, you might be a charity with a chain of shops or restaurants or, you know, online store, you know, why would you not be able to, you know, rely on the pecker soft opt-in? It just didn't make sense at all. So I've always been a great advocate of, like, you know, push it, test it, you know, let the court decide. But none of our charity clients wanted to do that.
Yeah, I do agree with you. But, you know, in the terms of, I did an advice note, to provide advice to a client that was a charity in the past. And they raised a lot of questions in relation to the use or not use of soft opt-in in several situations. So there is a lot of questions. One of them was for the charity shop, and the other one for lotteries and fundraisings, et cetera, et cetera. And we came across the ICO guidance that states that it's true that the charities are non-for-profit organizations. But for example, in the charity shop, because they are actually providing a commercial service and they receive money for it, they can be included in the soft opt-in. But well, still.
But I mean, in practical terms, you know, well, let's say the DUA bill comes into effect. Was it May, somebody was suggesting last week? So, okay, we can now rely on the soft opt-in. But if you haven't complied with all the conditions. Which they won't have done, because why would they when they weren't allowed to rely on the soft opt-in, then it's going to take a long time. They have to have a strategic approach to obtaining consent. One of the interesting things, I know nobody wants to listen to about Jamaican law, but in Jamaican law, and the kind of similar thing, they have the soft opt-in, but as a data control, you're allowed to approach a data subject where you don't have consent for consent, but you're only allowed to do that once. You get one shot at asking for consent. So in the ICO again says, oh no, you can't email somebody asking for consent. You can't do that, can you? But again, that why not? Why not? Why not say you could do it once? And once you've had that, blown that chance, you know, it's an offence then to try again. But that's how it is in this Jamaican.
To be honest, Phil, I tend to agree with you. I feel that is a lot of bureaucracy, and I feel sometimes really stuck when we are dealing with charities. And to be honest, like my personal opinion as a consultant and actually what the law says is completely conflicted, because I feel it's completed is wrong. So when I saw this as an amendment for the DUA bill, I was looking for it, and I'm quite excited if this is going to be approved. Obviously, to understand how they surely will have like a deadline for that charities actually need to implement and meet all the requirements and the PACA at least 1 year, 2 years.
Yeah, they're going to then end up in the same scenario as everybody else. Is how similar is a similar product or service? So, you know, some charities that we work with are very complex. They sell education. Yes. They're a governing body, aren't they? Royal Life Saving Society, for instance, is the governing body for lifesavers, manages the qualifications for lifesavers, sells life-saving equipment, surfboards, you know, bob floats. Does fundraising, has shops, you know, it's a very complex organization. So, you know, they're going to have to tread through, you know, complex charities are going to have to tread through the whole thing. Now, I remember when I worked at Everton Football Club a long time ago, I had an interesting discussion with some of our legal advisors, because, again, I was of the view that if somebody is a fan of Everton Football Club and is buying products from Everton Football Club, then they wouldn't necessarily not expect to hear from Everton Football Club about other non-similar products and services. I might buy match tickets. You know, is hospitality similar to a match ticket? Don't know. You know, is advertising opportunities is advertising opportunities, you know, similar to hospitality? It's all commercial or you know, oriented stuff. So I said, well, I think that, you know, if I put myself in the position of a fan, I think that I would expect to hear or would not object to hearing from the club about things that aren't necessarily similar, but it's all Everton stuff. Now, I wouldn't expect to hear from you know, other organisations, you know, via Everton.
Yeah.
So again, it's how elastic is this notion of similar products and services? You know, is it the brand that people expect? Yeah. Is it actually the product of the?
I think in terms of when we are trying to find that, it's actually just the power and the ability of the individual, the control in this case, to actually justify why they are similar products. And to be honest, it's just is the wording, because, I remember still on this client, we had this discussion about still on the soft opt-in, et cetera. But could it be in the charity shop, if we sell this type of product, that means that we can only use it for this product in specific or characteristics about this product or as a charity shop? Another question was about the lottery. Could be considered or not.
A lot of lotteries. So you buy your Christmas cards from the RNLI.
Yeah.
You know, you know, would you expect to receive, you know, information about, you know, some clothing line that they might have, or tea towels? Mm. You know, how is that a similar product?
Yeah.
But do you think the reason, though, why they've kind of always excluded charities is because they feel like charities would abuse it? So say, for example, someone was to go to a shop or go to a restaurant and buy something and then start sending them something about a fundraising campaign. Me personally, if I went to a charity shop and bought a book because, you know, for whatever reason, maybe because it was cheaper, or like a vinyl because it's cheaper than going and buying it firsthand, I wouldn't then expect that charity to reach out to me and say, listen, you know, would you give us £10 a month to help with this or whatever? So I think that's maybe where the ICO has probably perhaps always kind of steered away from charities, maybe because of the threat that it could get abused.
David.
Yeah. I think, Joe, almost it's a double negative. You wouldn't expect, I think you would expect, whether you'd want to support them is an entirely different question. But if I'm going into age concern, animal, whatever it is, a charity shop and purchasing and providing my details, do I think they're going to contact me? I think I'd make a fairly good argument that I do, and that my presence there is probably to support that charity. I think if I was the other side, Joe, I'd make a pretty conclusive argument. I get your point. You might not be going to accept it because you only went in there for it's cheaper, but I would guess 70-80% of the people in there are probably in there for something. You know, I'm not suggesting I'm a frequent stopper at charity shops, but if I do, it's probably the animal one on the high street for exactly that reason. Do I expect they're going to reach out to me? I do. Am I going to sign up to it? Probably not. But it's that expectation piece, isn't it? It's like the, you know, if I apply for one job, is it appropriate to reach out for another job in our organisation? We say it, you know, our position that it is, that if you're interested in working for us, then if we've got another position, you know, for the next, however long, actually we do it on however long we keep it for other reasons, for the period of time that we lawfully retain your data, we'll continue to market our other roles to you. Unless, of course, you opt out and we have all the other processes and those good things. But we make a statement and we say that's the way of going. So I think you probably would expect them. But yeah, I'm guessing it is because charities push it. I mean, there was a huge case, wasn't there? I think Phil will probably remember. I think it was the Heart Foundation. Others were selling data to each other. And there was some serious misuse of personal data by the charities at one point in time.
Yeah, it was quite a while ago. There was, I think, 13 charities in the end got fined. British Heart Foundation, Battersea Dogs Home. I can't remember all of them. This is probably about 2009. And I think it was about after that that the ICO really clamped down and said no. Yeah. But, you know, is that any worse abuse of people's rights and the double glazing firms or the PPI firms or, you know, that are getting fined, you know? I think, you know, in a way, data is there to get used, isn't it? You know, it's there collected to get used. It has to get commercialized. You know, there's no point collecting it for the sake of collecting data. You're collecting it for a reason. And, you know, the law is meant to work with us to help us use that data in a responsible way. So, you know, again, I would say that I think there are probably checks and balances in place, you know, and if people ignore the checks and balances and, you know, ignore people's right to opt out, then yes, you know, hit them hard. But I don't see why. I really don't see why, you know, you're not allowed to reach out and say, look, you know, you came and you bought something. We didn't ask you at the time if you wanted to hear from us. Do you want to hear from us? No, I don't. All right, fine. You know, we won't ask you again. But why can't you do that? It just doesn't make sense that you can't.
You do have to give the chance for them to opt out, though, don't you, at the point of collecting the data to find a soft option.
Yeah.
But that's not given, is it? Because, I mean, well, not always anyway. Because, I mean, for example, I imagine when you go into a shop, right, they've started doing things, haven't they, where they give you your receipt via email. Oh, have you got a receipt for your email? So they're collecting my data in the course of a negotiation or a sale, but they're not asking me if I want to opt out of direct marketing. And then from that organization, I'll start to receive direct marketing.
Well, you might find is that if you've got any sense, there's a privacy notice on the wall of the change rooms and, you know,
wish for the door that is behind the counter privacy policy saying that we're going to start direct
on the back of your receipt. Yeah. Check the back of your receipt.
Well, it's in an email, isn't it? But yeah, next time I get one, I'll have a look, see what it says. But I think it can be abused, and I think it is abused. And I just think maybe that's why it has perhaps been before.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see. It'd be interesting how it kind of works its way through in the doer bill. But I think it's long overdue change if that change is adopted. Now, what you also want to talk about the EU, the European Court of Justice ruling, didn't you, as well? The, you know, GDPR complaints can't be rejected on the basis of frequency. So what was the background? Was it Austria? Was it? I can't remember where it was now.
Yeah, it was Austria.
Yeah, trying to find the notes on it. I think it was someone had 77 complaints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, between over the course of 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, and apparently that individual was also contacting the data controller by phone, you know, with additional requests. And I think the data controller said, no, mm-hmm. we're going to limit you to maximum of two complaints per month. Anyway, the European Court of Justice said that, you know, the frequency of complaint isn't justification on its own for it being mm-hmm. excessive. I think that was the gist of it, was it?
Yeah, and he said that was more about the abusive intent behind them rather than the fact that being excessive or not. It's true. I think this case is really interesting because it's true that the GDPR does not clarify what is actually excessive. It is true that this case law was based on the Article 57.4, so in terms of the tasks of the data protection authority, etc. But the decision clarifies the meaning of what it means excessive requests, and I think we can use this as actually for our Article 15. And I think it's a quite good point because it's true that there were 77 complaints or requests, but that doesn't mean anything because it's actually, if it was for different intention or purpose and actually different matters and different subjects and different requests, etc., I think it's quite legit. I don't think it's excessive. And
from memory, there's something in the recitals, isn't there, which suggests that. You know, one of the reasons for the right of access is to help data subjects check, you know, at intervals, you know, that what's going on with the data from memory. I can't remember what recital it is, but yeah, you're right. You could raise one complaint about one thing, and then the next month a complaint about something different, and the next month a complaint about something different. You know, and so the actual frequency of complaints, on its own, on the face of it, isn't. Mm-hmm. Good argument.
But if it's a complaint about the same thing, then you'll have more weight behind it. And obviously that's why the CGEU is obviously giving that kind of emphasis that it's about the nature of the request as opposed to the frequency.
Did you see that, David, that ruling?
I didn't actually, which makes it quite exciting. It's something I have to look at. However, I would guess that I would think the thing that they really don't like is the limitation.
Yeah.
So as in say
that blanket
policy.
Because
they could, because virtually everything in the legislation, even where you are manifestly excessive, you've got to look at each one and make that claim. Yeah. So pre-limiting is predetermined. And therefore, I think what they're saying or what you could read, and I have to look through, but I've seen other similar, I can't remember where the other one was, but it's almost you're limiting without looking. And what it says is you've got to, on an individual case, you could deem it excessive because it's repeatedly. I mean, Joe mentioned the same area. That's definitely, you know, one bit that we've pushed back on before. But yeah, it'd be really interesting to look at. I've got an interesting bit of European law unless you're not finished on this one.
Crack on, David.
I saw some. I'm doing some work actually with the team on pay transparency in the EU, and it's coming to the UK as well as it was in the King's Speech, so watch for this. But there's some EU pay transparency legislation, which is all very good, but clearly is going to be processing huge volumes of personal information at an individual level because you've got to correct in discrepancies, you've got to know who you're processing it about. And there's two really good pieces in there. It talks about intersectional pay discrepancies. So that's where race interacts with gender or disability. However, it goes on to make explicitly clear in this case that they only expect you to record data on gender. So because at first you read it and you think, wow, well, wouldn't you think it legitimizes the collection of race and disability, it would be the lawful basis in most countries if that had stood without the latter piece. But then it removes it, takes it away, makes it clear you're not expected to collect that, which I really like. But one of the things we've really struggled is when you're creating this volume, these types of data sets, especially in large organizations, generally you're going to use data pooling, data lake type technologies, and what you're beginning to do is exposing your data up for further use. That really concerns me as the owner of all our HR data, and it's one of the biggest challenges we've had. It's definitely the right type of technology to do this type of reporting, because you're going to be aggregating data from many sources. There is Article 12 that explicitly, I mean, literally one line explicitly says, you will not use this data for any other purpose. Mm. I mean, how cool is that from our point of view? And it's a bit challenging if you really want to, but it makes it really explicit. If you're processing it for this purpose, you shall not use it for any other purpose. Mm-hmm. I really like that. It's like two there are two very clear examples in that legislation where they've thought about data protection as they're writing the legislation. Because clearly that's why I'm involved. It's very challenging from a data protection perspective. But yeah, it's one to look at, and one that I notice is in our King's speech. Therefore, you know, I'm guessing we're going to start to be looking at collecting disability and ethnicity in detail, which is something that is currently challenging, I believe, in the UK. But yeah.
All right. Very good. Good point. Have you got a link to that, David, at all?
Which one, the King's speech or the EU?
If you get a chance, just stick us a link in if you don't mind. I'll have a quick look. I'll be interested to have a look at that. Well, you have put some notes. You want to talk about lots more things, you two, because I've seen it in the notes that you put together whilst I've been away. So, but we've run out of time, I'm afraid. So there's like pages, there's lots of pretty graphs in these notes you've put together as well, but we have not talked about those at all, have we? So maybe we'll pick them up on the news next week, maybe.
Yeah, I thought the graphs would grab your attention. You always like a graph, don't you, Phil?
Oh, I like pretty pictures.
But as always, we always run out of time, don't we? So
indeed,
yeah, we'll save it for next Friday.
Yeah. So, well, thank everybody very much for joining us. I hope that was, well, whatever it was, interesting, thought-provoking, useful, maybe none of those. But we do appreciate you joining us. Have a great weekend, and hopefully we'll catch up with you next week.
Cheers, guys. See you
later.
Thank
you. Bye. Thank you.